Radio 4. It's 2 minutes past three.
For our play today, we visit Paris in the year 1895, where, amid the glamour of life in the naughty 90s, gentlemen, murder is served.
Well, I still think it sounds pretty tame. Spending the evening with a grey-beard professor isn't my idea of fun. Yeah, anyway, what's an Englishman like him doing living here?
Just wait till you meet him, Charles. You'll find him capital company. Here's a fund of stories. You said you wanted me to show you the real Paris? Well, no one knows it better than Hector Porteous. As to why he lives here, well, he likes Paris. And Paris likes him. He's probably the finest anatomist in Europe. The university was lucky to get hold of him.
Well, all right. You've always got your own way ever since we were children. All I ask is that we go on to somewhere interesting afterwards.
Oh.
Damn it, Philip. I've been stuck with the army in South Africa for 3 years, surrounded by ignorant Kaffirs and stubborn Boers. Now, do you know what kept me going amidst the heat and dust and flies on the veldt?
Yeah.
It was the thought of having a really good time in Paris with my old friend and cousin, Philip Delamain. And by good time, I mean what every red-blooded Englishman means. Wine, woman and song.
Yes, well, I just thought you might like a change this evening. Something different? You'll like old Porteous, I promise you. His anatomy lectures at the Sorbonne were always hilarious. Hilarious and sometimes sinister.
Sinister?
Yeah. He was for many years a police advisor on forensic medicine. Some of the tales he'd tell, well... Anyway, you'll get a good dinner out of it. Le Grand Véfour is one of the best restaurants in Paris, and that means one of the best in the world.
Yeah. You know what I think about Frenchified food?
You just be on your best behaviour. Right, here we are.
Merci, monsieur. No, tenez,
c'est right.
After you, Giles.
Bonjour, monsieur. Vous avez une réservation?
Oui, Captain Danvers et Dr. Delamain. Nous avons rendez-vous avec le professeur Porteous.
Ah, bien entendu. Monsieur le professeur est déjà ici.
Ah.
Suivez-moi, s'il vous plaît.
Oui, merci. Bon.
Philip, how wonderful to see you again. Oh, I was so pleased to receive your letter.
Professor, how are you? Allow me to present my cousin, Captain Giles Danvers, of Her Majesty's 4th Dragoon Guards.
Enchanté, Captain Danvers.
How do you do, sir?
Well, sit down, sit down. Tell me all your news, Philip. How many patients have you killed since you qualified?
Well, not nearly as many as I would if I'd followed your recommendation to become a surgeon.
Oh. Well, I always told you you were a professional licensed murderer. Well, what else could I do? I open him up again and put him back. here's George. He's a first-class head waiter. You just watch him, Captain Danvers. Runs this place like an army brigade.
Monsieur le professeur, vous êtes prêt?
Oui, Georges, très affamé. I hope you don't mind. I've taken the liberty of ordering our meal because I wanted you to enjoy the very best food and wine Paris could offer. And I hope you approve my choice. Bien, Georges, j'espère qu'il sont frais.
Oh, naturellement, professeur. Nous marchons ce matin.
Yes. Gentlemen, I could not let you leave Paris without tasting one of our great delicacies. Now, watch carefully. Georges removes the cover, and voila. Escargot farci varié.
My God, they look like...
Like snails, Giles. That's exactly what they are.
Good God. I know the frogs eat some damn queer things, but snails? Ugh. No wonder the French are such useless soldiers. They all had their guts rotted from the inside.
Captain Danvers, Philip told me you wanted to steep yourself in all the pleasures of Paris. Well, for a real Frenchman, the delights of the table surpass even those of the bedroom, eh? And don't worry, the snails have been washed in brine to get rid of the slime. Well, try them. You'll be surprised. Each one is individually farci. It's such a better word than our English stuffed. With a different filling. flavoured with roquefort, fennel, garlic, various spices. Oh, and the wine I know you'll enjoy. It's a Condrieu from Dauphiné, with all the colour and sparkle of rippling sunlight on the Rhône.
Ah. Professor, are you still advisor in forensic medicine to the Sûreté?
Yes, but I'm not so involved as I used to be. There don't seem to be the really interesting cases these days. Merveilleux. Philip, did I ever tell you about the murders in Rue Montaigne?
No, but I know that look in your eye. You've come prepared to tell us, haven't you?
Well, I just happen to have the notes of the affair here in this special case.
What an extraordinary note case. Odd colour. Covered in vellum, is it?
Yeah, I'll come to that in due course. It was for me a particularly interesting affair because I was involved in it from the very beginning. Even before the beginning. Right to the very end. And perhaps even beyond the end. That's why I've kept all these jottings and photographs and press cuttings in this remarkable note case. It is the story of a very beautiful woman. Beautiful and sad. Now picture to yourself, gentlemen, a lady just past her first youth, but now possessing that hauteur, that self-assurance of manner that most men find quite irresistible. A woman, slender build, with green eyes and glistening gold hair, immaculately coiffed. A woman whose defiant tilt of the head and penetrating gaze mark her as a creature of spirit who has triumphed over many of life's little sadnesses. Well, you could see in your mind's eye such a woman. Mm-hmm. Then you see Régine de Monti. That day in March 1887, when I observed her phaeton rushing along the Bois de Boulogne, I knew it was her, long before I was close enough to distinguish the face beneath her veil. A single lady, elegant, her carriage open despite the bitter cold, driving with such speed, style, grace. Oh, it could only be she. I doffed my hat. Instead of passing, Madame de Monti reined in suddenly.
Dr. Porteous!
At your service, madame.
Are you on your way to a patient?
It is only my own health that brings me to the Bois today.
Then you shall spend a moment or two with someone who needs your ministrations. Come up into the carriage and sit with me a while.
When beauty commands, age must obey.
This is very kind. Here, the rug for your legs.
Oh, thank you. Now, what's this about needing my humble services? I fear I shall diagnose hypochondria. I never saw you looking more radiant, madame.
Up. Hercules. Leander, up.
For several minutes, she made no reply. He had left the Avenue du Bois, crossed the Place de l'Étoile, and entered the Avenue des Champs-Élysées before she uttered another long sigh.
Oh, Dr. Porteous, I am so unhappy. I wish I were dead.
My poor child, what's the matter?
I cannot. But yes, I must tell someone. My dear friend, I can trust your discretion.
Of course.
3 weeks ago, my lover, Paul Saint-Genier, left me to get married.
Oh, that is very sad. But to wish for death, no.
But I loved him passionately. I still do. He's the only one I care for. Oh, Dr. Porteous, what am I to do?
Oh, why distract yourself? You have other men.
Only two that matter. Young Renier, he is sweet. He pays for the apartment. And your friend Lagrange.
What? Old Pascal? The lucky old goat.
He is kind and understanding. He gives me 1,000 francs a month. There are two or three more, but they are just business.
Saying that this Madame de Monti was a common...
My friend, whatever Régine de Monti was, she was not common. Ah, but I must pause. Here's our next course. Now, this is a light dish of goose livers and sep, but that is wild mushrooms, and a piquant salad. And we shall have with it a fresh little wine from Anjou. Merci, Georges. Where was I? Madame de Monti. Well, her origins were humble, certainly. The daughter of a small town official, seduced at 17 by a local farmer who discarded her after a year. Disowned by her family, she made a living with the only gift nature had bestowed generously upon her, her beauty. Little Regine passed from man to man, but never did she give herself dishonorably. She chose her friends with care. One of her liaisons was with a certain Chevalier de Monti. She took his name and kept it after the affair had ended.
She managed to avoid getting herself pregnant.
Well, such ladies are well versed in various stratagems. But certainly when she arrived in Paris, some 3 years before the events I'm describing, she had with her a maid, Annette Grémeret, and a little girl of 5 years, Marie. The child was supposed to be Annette's, the result of an affair with a coachman, but... Captain Danvers, you're not enjoying your foie d'huile?
The damn things are raw.
No, they're marinated in wine and herbs, and then sautéed ever so lightly in oil with the mushrooms. But you must not probe it so delicately with your knife. We're not in the operating theatre. Look, my friend, like this. A little liver, a little mushroom on the fork, and some crisp endive. Rub it well in the oil, and voila. Super. That's the way to appreciate all the textures and flavors. You try it. That's right. You know, Philip, this is a favorite dish of old Lamartine, the professor of obstetrics. He says it gives him a sensation which must be like eating newborn babies.
Giles, my poor chap. You need a good thump on the back.
Oh, that's enough. Sorry. Must have gone down the wrong way.
Yeah. Drink some more wine.
Georges?
Monsieur?
Encore une bouteille de saumure?
Oui, monsieur.
To go back to your story, Professor, this distressed woman, I suppose she wanted you to prescribe opium or morphine.
No, it's what I suspected, of course, but she was adamant in rejecting any such idea.
Drugs. I have no use for them. Absinthe, occasionally. Or some other distraction.
What distraction?
Why, anything new, different, diverting. The nights are the worst time after my regular lovers have gone. What if I'd met some strange man or even woman to help me endure the dark hours?
Well, this is folly, my dear child. You must know the risk you run. Thieves! Violent men. You've heard about these terrible murders in the last few months. 4 women brutally done to death.
Risk? But that puts interest, excitement back into life. Hercules, Leander, Herb.
Madame, you'll have us over. Please, if you care nothing for your own life, I implore you, think of mine. Oh, I'm obliged.
Oh, Dr. Fortress. What shall I do? I'm so wretched.
There, my poor child. Here, dry your eyes. I'll tell you what your old friend Hector prescribes. A rest. Change your air. Go to Cannes or Nice or Monte Carlo for a few weeks. If you need something to help you sleep, I'll give you a prescription for some bromide of laudanum.
I suppose you are right. Perhaps I will take a little holiday. No drugs. At least, not for the present. But please, please, will you come and see me at the weekend? Saturday afternoon?
With the greatest of pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. Oh, I feel better already. Just talking to you is a cure in itself. Now, let me drive you home.
No. Thank you. No, it's not far, and the walk, is good for the circulation. Au revoir, madame.
Until Saturday, dear Dr. Porteous. Hercules, Leander! Up!
Poor woman.
Poor indeed. Not materially, of course. In fact, she was very prosperous. Her admirers showered her with gifts. She had some splendid jewellery. And she was very careful with money. But she had come to a point in life where she felt she had nothing. No one she really loved, no close friends, nothing to dedicate her life to. Very sad. Ah, well, here's Georges with something special for us. Merci, Georges. You are a fisherman, Captain Danvers?
Yes, I do a bit on the family's place in Gloucestershire and sometimes with friends in Scotland.
Well, here's a dish you'll really enjoy. Truite au vin d'Arbois. The trout is cooked in a vin rosé from Franche-Comté and served with a rich cream sauce. And to accompany it, a fine Montrachet, indubitably the best white wine in the world.
The fish looks excellent. It smells quite delicious. Don't you think so, Giles?
Yeah, if you like fancy food. For me, a trout is a trout. I like to see what I'm eating. I don't care for these effeminate sauces.
But, Captain Danvers, surely you
would... Professor, tell us what happened the next time you saw Madame de Monti.
Ah, alas, I never saw her again. At least, not alive. 3 days after our meeting in the Bois, I was roughly awakened by my manservant.
Professor! Professor!
Oh, whatever is it, Pierre? What's the matter?
You must get dressed quickly, Professor. The police are here.
I was, of course, quite used to being summoned urgently by the police to examine the bodies of people who have died in suspicious circumstances. Wretches fished out of the Seine, footpad victims, that sort of thing. So I was soon ready and went with the gendarme who had been sent by cab to fetch me. Only when the driver turned into the Rue Montaigne and stopped outside number 17 was I filled with a terrible foreboding. It was the building where Régine de Monti had her apartment. We pushed through the little crowd and climbed to the second floor. At the door of the flat, I was met by Inspector Tailleur of the Sûreté.
Morning, Porteous. Afraid it's a very nasty one. Same pattern as the other four women, but... Well, come and see.
Nasty was hardly the word for it. At the far end of the narrow passageway, by the door of Régine de Monti's bedroom, lay a woman's crumpled body. Blood spattered the walls and lay in a large congealed pool on the green carpet. The poor creature was wearing a petticoat. Her nightcap lay on the floor beside her. I knelt by the corpse.
Well, Professor, what can you tell us?
This is Annette Grévray, the maid.
You knew her?
Madame de Monti is a patient of mine.
Was a patient.
She too?
I'm afraid so. You'll see in a moment. For the present, we're concerned with the manner of Mademoiselle Grémeret's death.
Very well. Help me to turn her onto her back, will you? That's right. Ah, now we can see the fatal wound there across the throat. Very clean cut. Note the expression on the face.
Looks perfectly tranquil to me.
Precisely. No bulging eyes, no opening of the mouth to scream, no contortion of the features. The poor woman was taken completely by surprise. From the position of the cut, I'd say she was expertly dispatched. Hair grabbed from behind with the left hand, throat slit with the other. Identical to the Agaton and Stein murders.
Yet there are slashes here on the shoulders.
Yeah, yes, but these were made after the fatal blow. I mean, he must have been agitated, excited to inflict these unnecessary wounds. Yet he had the presence of mind to dispatch his victim cleanly, clinically.
I don't wonder he was keyed up. Come through here, Porteous. Into the bedroom.
My God.
Ghastly, isn't it? I don't mind admitting I've never seen anything worse.
The elegant chamber where Régine de Monti had exercised her not inconsiderable talents was a shambles. The purple damask hangings over the rosewood bed were torn. Wardrobe doors gaped open. Drawers had been pulled out and their contents scattered. There were splashes of blood over the crumpled sheets and the wall. Had the room not had a scarlet carpet, the profuse emission of blood would have been even more apparent. But nothing could conceal the smell of carnage. Not even the fragrance of Régine's perfume, which still pervaded the air. As for the wretched woman herself,
She lay on her side, at the foot of the bed, her hands stretched out towards the wall. I stood for some moments in the doorway, stunned by the horror of the scene. But there was work to be done, as the efficient Inspector Tailleur pointed out.
Well, come along, Porteous. I want all you can tell me about this dreadful business. We have to find some way to put a stop to these crimes.
Of course. Yeah, well, you'll observe that the fatal blow is identical to the one which killed the maid.
There seems to have been a struggle.
Yes. Poor Madame de Bonty did not die with merciful suddenness. There's a wound here across her left shoulder which has penetrated to the bone. The gash across her neck is very deep, and the chain she was wearing is crushed into it.
See over here, Porteous. There's blood on the pillow and on the wall beside the bed by the bell rope.
Oh, yes. Yes, and look at the rope. It's almost detached at the top. Not very difficult to reconstruct the crime. The lady's attacked as she gets out of bed. Her first instinct is to summon aid. She grabs the bell pull. Her assailant grabbed her to try and stop her raising the alarm, drags her to the foot of the bed. There, despite her struggles and screams, he manages to inflict the fatal wound. By now, Annette Weyvray, aroused by the violent ringing of the bell, is knocking at the door. The murderer is flustered, close to panic, but he has the presence of mind to step across the room and flatten himself against the wall beside the door. As soon as the maid opens it, before she has time to step across the threshold, he seizes her by the hair and cuts her throat. The body naturally convulses in its death spasms. He fears she is still alive. He strikes her again and again.
Thank you, Porteous. Very graphic. But is there anything that tells us more about the kind of man we're looking for?
Well, all these wounds suggest a sharp knife with a long blade. Something like a butcher's knife or a carving knife. As to the assassin, obviously strong, and I'd say he knew exactly what he was doing. There are no stab wounds on the bodies. He wields his weapon expertly, like a butcher. It all confirms what we already know. We're dealing with a calculating, ruthless killer. Insane, certainly, but with the cunning of the devil himself.
You haven't seen the worst yet. Come with me. Here, at the end of the passage, is the room shared by the maid with her daughter Marie. Prepare yourself for another shock, Porteous.
He flung open the door and...
Not the little girl as well.
The child Marie lay huddled up in the middle of the large bed she shared with the maid. Her head was severed almost completely from the body. It remained attached by a mere shred of skin. Her right arm, which she'd instinctively raised to protect herself, was deeply gashed in several places.
How ghastly.
Oh, indeed. But then man is but animal when we've removed the wrappings we call civilization. Captain Danvers, I think you've seen that often enough. These South African atrocities we read about.
The exaggerations. The anti-British propaganda. The truth is that damned Boers train their women and children to attack our troops. Every farmhouse is a potential source of danger. Well, it's not our fault if we have to round them up to keep them out of mischief.
I suppose you're right. Doubtless the stories of hundreds of women and children dying in the camps are exaggerated. We civilized British would never permit such a thing.
Monsieur le professeur, le requis est très vous permettre.
Ah, my friends, our next course. Oui, Georges, vous le pouvez servir.
Et le vin, c'est ici, monsieur. Le sommelier va vous le présenter.
Merci. Oh, gentlemen, I have the great honor to present to you a king among wines. His Majesty Chateau Lafitte, 1864. Oh, there could be nothing finer to accompany our beef.
Aha, beef, eh?
Yes, bœuf rôti à la Bordelaise. It is marinated in wine, oil, and herbs, and served with reduced juices and marinade as a sauce. But while George is carving, I thought you'd be interested to see the police photographs taken at the scene of the murder. This is what we found in Madame de Monti's bedroom. And here's poor little Marie. Even at a distance, you can see the head lying quite unnaturally in relation to the body. Ah, and here's a close-up photograph, which is really very good. It'll interest you especially, Philip. Mm. You see there, the spinal vertebrae, completely severed. Yes. Captain Danvers, please let George help you to more meat than that. The roasting chef here is the best in Paris.
Just look at this loin. Crisp on the outside, but at the centre, bright pink and still moist with blood.
Thank you. I have enough.
Oh, no, I insist. Georges, tout de viande pour monsieur.
Remarkable photographs. These modern techniques must be a great help in police work. But you say that this was part of a series of murders?
Yes. Four other women had been butchered in exactly the same way over the previous 18 months. Three in Montmartre, and one in a street close to the Rue de Montaigne.
All prostitutes?
All unfortunate women of the same calling as poor Régine. Whatever you may think of that calling, they had as much right to life as the Queen at Windsor.
And this butcher was running rings around the Frog police.
Tyre was in charge of the case, but he'd made no progress. A fact which the ever-vigilant press were not slow to point out. I have some cuttings here. This is typical. It's from Le Figaro.
Since the summer of 1885, four women of the same class as Régine de Monti have been murdered. Marie Fellerath, Maria Join, Hélène Stein, and Marie Agouton. No trace of the assassin has been found by the incompetent Monsieur Tailleur? The police have the audacity to charge the press with hindering their investigations. It would be better if they devoted their energies to tracking down the criminal. Only when he is behind bars will women feel safe on the streets of the capital.
No, poor Tailleur, he didn't deserve that. I mean, there was no better man on the force. Patient, thorough. But unfortunately, he was under constant pressure from his superiors and the press for a quick result.
I should jolly well think so.
Well, anyway, while I was examining the bodies in greater detail, he and his two assistants went through the apartment with a fine-tooth comb. After about half an hour, Tailleur came to the maid's room where I was working.
Quarters, it would not be possible, I imagine, for the murderer to avoid bloodstains on his clothing.
Oh, quite impossible. The severed arteries and blood had sprayed all over the place.
As I thought. So if the crime was premeditated, he would take his clothes off.
If he'd been admitted here for the normal purpose, it would be remarkable if he kept his clothes on for very long.
Quite so. But he would take care to place them out of the way, behind a window curtain, for instance.
That would certainly be prudent. You found some clue?
I'm not sure. The man clearly wandered around naked, taking what he could find. There are bloody footprints in the drawing room, fingerprints all over the safe. The state of the bathroom shows that he cleaned himself thoroughly before leaving. Behind the curtain in the bedroom, we discovered this belt. As you see, it has a name printed on the back. Gaston Geissler.
Then your murderer seems to have left his calling card.
Two calling cards. Under Madame de Monti's body, we found this man's cuff. Mm-hmm. It has the cufflink still in it. A monographed cufflink.
And the initials RGG?
Yes.
Well, then, Inspector, you're in luck. Your man's been doubly careless.
Possibly. But how did the cuff get under the body? Are we to imagine the murderer performing his terrible deed stark naked except for one cuff, which then falls off without him noticing?
Excuse me, Inspector.
Well, Lemoine, what is it?
Something you ought to see, sir. A letter. It was on the floor behind the dressing table.
Thank you, Lemoine. When you've finished in the bedroom, I want you to collect everyone who was in the building last night and start taking statements. You can use the concierge's apartment.
Sir.
Now then, what have we got here? My dear Régine, I have just arrived from Nancy, the portrait... Well, Porteous, it seems we now have three calling cards. Listen to this. My dear Régine, I have just returned from Nancy. The portrait is ready. I've put the finishing touches to the dress. I have paid out the 500 francs you lent me. That brute of a tradesman was annoying me, so thank you for your kindness. I will come to you tomorrow. Till then, my one hope, I kiss you where my burning lips bring you your one delight. Gaston. P.S. Be sure to destroy this as you always do.
There's an address on the letter.
Now.
Oh, pity. Your murderer seems to have done everything to invite arrest except tell you where to find him.
He doesn't sound much like the cool, calculating monster we envisage, does he?
Even the cleverest criminal makes mistakes, as you know, my friend. At last you have a real lead. It's an important breakthrough.
Odd, isn't it? Four separate murders and no trace of a clue. Now suddenly the place is littered with evidence. I'm beginning to get a feel for this man. I think he's playing with us.
But you cannot ignore Monsieur Geissler.
No, that's the devil of it. I shall have to set men onto looking for this artist, while the culprit may be laughing at me up his sleeve.
My dear fellow, I think you're making the case more complicated than it is. Geissler's your man, depend upon it.
Well, we shall see. For the moment, I prefer to keep an open mind.
Inspector Tailleur was a very experienced investigator.
That sounds like a bit of an idiot to me. Well, anyone who thinks murderers and thieves are clever is only making them more important than they are, giving them a sort of romance. Well, take these Sherlock Holmes stories that are all the rage in England. They only make crime seem attractive. They show the police up as fools and encourage thugs to try their luck. Now, we've a short way with them in the army, I can tell you. Some of your Sûreté people might learn a thing or two if they watch some English court-martials.
Well, I'll certainly pass on that invaluable suggestion. In the Rue Montaigne case, things certainly seemed first to be very straightforward. Tailleur took statements from the concierge, Monsieur Lacarrière, and his wife.
It was close on 11:30 last night when I saw a man come into the house. And the collar of his coat was turned up. He wore a top hat. He looked quite respectable. As he passed my lodge, he called out, Madame de Monti, without asking for the number of her flat. He wore a grey scarf, her muffler, and the man was slim. He had a black moustache.
I knew something like this would happen. I knew it. After that nice Vicomte de Jenny went away, she took to drinking absinthe and began accepting men she knew nothing about.
Oh, poor madame.
And the little girl was such an angel.
Madame, collect yourself. Did you see the man who came last night?
Yes. When he passed the lodge and called out her name.
Well, what did he look like?
Oh, a gentleman. Or so he seemed. He'd called on Madame de Monti before, but I didn't know his name.
Come, madame, this is little help to us. Can you tell us no more? But was he tall, short, thin, fat, fair, dark?
Oh, short, certainly. Short and thin. Skinny, almost. He looked as though he could use a good meal. And his hair was brown, yes. Definitely brown.
And no one else visited the apartment last night?
No, monsieur. The door is locked at 11 o'clock. No one can come and go after that without my knowledge.
Did the police find this Geisler fellow? And did he match the concierge's description?
Oh, poor Tailleur. What a merry dance this Geisler was to lead him. Within hours, the admirable superintendent had his men scouring the hotels and lodging houses of the city, and this bore fruit immediately. It took Tailleur to the Hotel Cailleur in the Rue Saint-Quentin.
Didn't like the look of him from the start. But in this business, one cannot be choosy, monsieur. Of course, if I'd realised that he was the one that's done all these murders...
He paid his bills?
Oh, he paid, eventually, whenever I threatened to put him out in the street. It was because he was so irregular that I moved him from one of my better apartments to this room at the top of the house. Voilà, monsieur. This is where your murderer has lived for the last few weeks.
Madame Jourdain, we do not know that Geisler is our man. We are only making inquiries.
Inquiries. Isn't his name Geisler? And didn't he leave on the afternoon of the 16th? And weren't those terrible murders done that very night? And hasn't he disappeared without trace, leaving all his belongings?
You say he called himself Henri Geisler.
Henri Gaston. Name in a hotel register, it means nothing. He also told me he was Austrian, and I didn't believe that either.
Well, thank you very much, madame. My colleague and I will examine the room carefully and return the key to you later.
Oh, I haven't got all day to come up and down these stairs looking after you, gentlemen.
Well, Lamont, what have we got?
Well, there's a battered travelling bag here under the bed.
Let's see what's in it, then.
Cigars from a shop in Cologne. Mm. Shirts, socks, two grubby collars.
Just a minute. Look at this. And this.
It's on the collars, too.
GG.
He's our man, right enough.
You think so, Lamont?
Well, surely there can't be any doubt, sir. The laundry marks are identical. And according to the hotel staff, he fits the picture.
Hmm. Well, we shall know much more when we've found Geisler. Somehow, I don't think that's going to be easy.
Mm. Have you ever tasted meat cooked to such perfection? I press you to more, but there are other delights to come. Georges, professeur?
Monsieur, tout va bien?
Oh, naturellement, mon ami. Monsieur Charles est un véritable magicien. Et maintenant, apportez les entremets, s'il vous plaît.
Tout de suite, monsieur.
I've ordered a selection of entremets. They are works of art. There are other words to describe them.
I'll wager your French police never found this Geisler fellow.
Ah, well, Captain Danvers, yes to that. More anon.
This was the moment at which there was a wholly new development in the case. On the evening of March the 20th, at the Grand Theatre, Marseille, a performance of The Barber of Seville was in progress. As the first interval approached, Inspector Cicaldi of the local police force quietly entered a box. Its sole occupant was a young man in immaculate evening dress. He looked up with a start as the inspector addressed him.
Monsieur Henri Pansini?
Yes?
Inspector Cicaldi, Marseille Police. Will you please be kind enough to accompany me to the bureau?
Accompany you to the... Certainly not. What's all this about?
Well, allow me to point out, monsieur, that I have two constables with me. If you don't come of your own free will, I shall be obliged to place you under restraint.
Very well. But you'll see that you're making a mistake.
Right, in here. Sit down there, if you please, monsieur, by the table. We have some acquaintances of yours here. Bring in Lebrun. Come in, Lebrun.
Look, Inspector, how much longer are you going to keep me? My cab's been standing idle outside an hour or more.
You can go when I say so. Now then, do you recognise this man?
Yeah, he hired me this afternoon. I picked him up at the restaurant Pascal.
And where did you take him?
Chez Aline, Rue Ventomachy.
Oh, the brothel?
Yeah, of course, the brothel. He stayed a couple of hours, he did. I reckon he must have got his money's worth.
Inspector, this fellow is clearly mistaken.
I know I ain't, mate. You get to know faces in my job.
Right, Lebrun, that'll do. You can go now.
Right.
Ask Madame Fontaine to come in on your way up.
Just what is all this about?
You'll find out soon enough, as if you didn't know. Ah, Madame Fontaine, come in. You've been most helpful already. I won't keep you much longer.
It's all right, Inspector. I always cooperate with the police, as you well know.
Take a good look at this gentleman, madame. Did he patronise your establishment this afternoon?
That he did, Inspector. He was entertained by Fleur and Elise, two of my best girls.
And what happened after he left?
Well, they came in to me all agitated. They're very good girls, very religiously brought up. All my girls are good girls, regular at mass and confession.
Just tell us what happened.
Yes, that's what I'm doing, Inspector. And as I said, they were very agitated. It seems this gentleman had sold them some jewellery for a few francs. He said they were cheap gimcracks, but of course I could see as soon as they showed them to me that they were high quality items.
Do you identify the articles in this box as the valuables in question?
Yes, Inspector. Lovely earrings and a charming little watch set with diamonds. Obviously valuable.
And you thought you'd check to see if they'd been stolen, in case there was a reward.
I did my duty as a citizen, Inspector.
Of course. Well, thank you, Madame Fontaine. I know you're a busy woman. I won't detain you any longer. Constable, see the lady out.
Well, if you're sure there's nothing...
Nothing.
Goodbye then, Inspector. Let me know if I can be of any further assistance. My girls and I...
Well now, Monsieur Pansini.
Oh, Inspector, if there should be a reward...
Madame, you will be the first to know. Goodbye.
Well, you don't seriously believe these wretches. Oh, you're not going to take the word of cabbies and women of the street against the word of a gentleman. Do I look like a common jewel thief?
You don't recognise these pieces of jewellery, of course.
I've never seen them before.
And you've no idea where they came from.
Well, how could I?
Then allow me to enlighten you, monsieur. For the last 2 years, as the press delight in pointing out, a particularly vile murderer has been on the loose in Paris. To date, he has claimed 7 victims. His last atrocity occurred 3 days ago, but this time there was a difference. This time the madman stole jewellery from his victim. Jewellery which could be traced. Jewellery which has been traced. Those items before you answer precisely to a description issued by the Office of the Sûreté in Paris. It seems that the experts in the capital do sometimes find use for us simple provincial policemen.
My God, you're not trying to connect me with this murder that's been in all the papers.
We've been pursuing our investigations in our dull provincial way, and we find your movements very interesting, Monsieur Prancini. You will not, I imagine, deny that you arrived in Marseille yesterday on the express train from Paris.
Along with at least 100 other people.
Well, we've notified our colleagues in the big city. Pending their arrival, we are holding you on suspicion of the murder of Madame Régine de Montiel.
So this Prancini was the man passing himself off as Henry Geisler, eh?
Oh, no. No, the mysterious Geisler, you recall, was a short man with a moustache, and so thin that he looked in need of a good meal. Only Prancini was 31 years old, well-built, above average height, and clean-shaven. Ah, but come, my friends, we are neglecting our victuals. Let's see what the good George has brought for us. Ah, roast truffles and... Oh, lobster au gratin. And what have we lurking under this cover? Grouse in sour cream. Oh, that you must try. It is made to a recipe by the great, the immortal, Carême.
Who on earth is Carême?
And this amazing Eiffel Tower in pastry. Now, that is the pièce de résistance, a speciality of Le Grand Véfour, a crisp eggshell thin crust concealing an exquisite combination of garlic, tomatoes, and calves' brains. I insist that you let me give you a little, Captain Danvers.
Thank you. No. Perhaps a portion, just a very tiny portion of the grouse. If Prancini wasn't the murderer, he must have received the jewels from the murderer. Presumably he could lead the police to him.
Prancini, it was an enigma. He denied all knowledge of the jewels and of Régine de Montiel until he was presented with incontrovertible evidence.
The police were able to connect him with the murdered woman?
Among the visiting cards on a tray in her drawing room was one bearing the name Henri Prancini. Yeah. Well, there was more than enough information to connect him to the crime, and by detaining and examining Prancini, the police could at last be seen to be doing something. But still, Tyre was not happy.
Ah, Porteous, thank you for being so prompt.
I came as soon as I received your message.
No, don't sit down. I want you to meet this Prancini fellow. You can spare me the time?
Of course.
Then we'll go straight away. I have a cab waiting.
My dear Tyre, I'm totally mystified. You've directed the cab to drive to the Rue Montaigne.
Inspecting Magistrate Monsieur Guillot has resolved upon a little experiment. He's taking Prancini to the scene of the crime.
Guillot thinks the prisoner will crack.
He's determined to wring a confession from Prancini.
But why do you want me there?
I want you to help me understand Pranzini's mind.
My dear Tyre, I am an expert in bodies, not minds. You should consult someone like Jean Charcot. He's doing some very interesting work at Salpêtrière Hospital. Of course, psychology is a very new science. In the end, it may not amount
to much. I can't go to any of these loony doctors. The surintendant would be furious. All he wants is a conviction against Prancini, and quickly.
And then...
I am the one who has to go into court and make a good case against this man. I have to persuade a jury that Prancini is the sort of man who could butcher 7 women in cold blood. The defense lawyers will make great play of the fact that Prancini does not fit the description of the man seen going into Madame de Monti's apartment.
Well, it was dark on the staircase. The visitor covered his face.
I'm not talking about legal arguments, Porteous. I want to know that Prancini is our man. You remember I said I felt the murderer was laughing at us, challenging us to outwit him. I felt that when I came face to face with the assassin, I would be quite sure to recognize him.
And you're not certain about Prancini?
He's a pretty pathetic creature.
Well, what have you found out about him?
It's rather a squalid story. He was born in Egypt and worked for the postal service there until he was caught pilfering registered letters. When he came out of prison, he seems to have gone straight for a time. He traveled in India and the Near East doing a variety of jobs. Quite a clever young man. Speaks 5 languages. By the time he returned to Europe, he was a compulsive gambler. He did everything he could think of to finance his obsession. He went through several jobs and was dismissed from most of them for petty theft.
Well, he certainly doesn't sound like a crazed killer of defenseless women.
Ah, but he is a ladies' man. Apparently, they find him quite irresistible. In recent years, that's how he's made his money, as a gigolo, picking up wealthy middle-aged women and living off them. That's his alibi for the time of the Rue Montaigne murders. He says he spent the entire night with a lady of quality.
That can easily be checked.
Oh, no. Our young gallant refuses to name her. A question of honour, he says.
Chivalry doesn't usually take men to the guillotine.
The guillotine. Ah, that's it. Supposing we get our conviction and Pranzini is executed. And supposing that the next week there's another of these ghastly murders. Watch him closely, Porteous. I really would like to know what you make of Monsieur Henri Pranzini.
My God! Oh, you didn't tell me the place had been left in this mess. It'll be the devil's own job to get those bloodstains off the wall and the carpet and the stench.
Monsieur Guillot's specific instructions. He has a taste for the dramatic. And here he comes on cue. Our instructions are to stand here, stage right, and say nothing.
You are, of course, familiar with the late Madame de Monti's bedroom, Pranzini?
I have never been in here before.
Look here at this bloodstained bed. Was this where you struck down Régine de Monti?
I have nothing to do with this business. And I swear it's the first time I've ever been in this
room. Was it here that the woman fell? Was it from this table that you stole the jewels found in your possession in Marseille?
I never had those jewels.
They were almost seen in your hands. The woman to whom you tried to sell them handed them over immediately to the police.
It was not I.
This safe even now bears bloodstains left by the murderer's fingers when he tried to open it.
I tell you, I have nothing to do with this business. And I repeat, I have never been in this room.
Ha! It was here on the threshold of this room that the maid was struck down as she was going to her mistress's aid. Come now to the room where the most terrible part of the tragedy took place.
I have never been in this room. I don't know it any more than the other one. I have never seen anything but the drawing room.
On this bed, all soiled with blood, the poor child was literally beheaded. The sight of this place where such awful events happened awakens no emotion in you?
It moves me, because I feel sorry for the poor victim.
You are the murderer! All the circumstances point to it, and your lies complete the proof.
I am not lying. I have not got this on my conscience.
You see, you are under a terrible charge, that you have committed a crime which has appalled the whole of France. For the last time, I appeal to you, here, in this dreadful place. If you are innocent, clear yourself. Tell me where you passed the night that these atrocious murders were committed.
I was with a lady.
A married lady?
Yes.
Her name? Strange, is it not, that this lady of quality, this aristocratic adulteress who holds you in such apparent esteem, is not prepared to come forward and save you from the guillotine? Your silence is more eloquent than any confession.
Surely, monsieur, it is for you to prove that I was here, not for me to prove that I was not.
Put this top hat on and come with me.
Top hat? What?
Do as you're told!
La Carrière!
Devil take the man. Where is he?
La Carrière! Coming, monsieur.
Stand just there, at the foot of the stairs, and fetch your wife.
Jean, come here. The magistrate wants you.
Good morning, monsieur le concierge.
Good morning.
What monsieur Guillot here wishes to know is whether you recognize me. Was I here the night those unfortunate women were murdered?
I'm not sure. I thought the man was smaller. But the face, no. Well, he had his collar turned up.
Like this?
That's right, yes.
Well?
I don't think he...
Go back a few steps up the stairs.
Oh, really? How long is this charade?
Come, La Carrière. Do you recognize this as the man who asked for Madame de Monti at 11:30 on the night of the 16th of March?
No, monsieur.
Madame?
No, monsieur.
There's nothing amusing about your situation, Pranzini. Inspector Tailleur, a word if you please. Tailleur, I want you to go through this place again, microscopically.
Monsieur Guillot.
Microscopically, Tailleur. Somewhere here is the proof that Pranzini committed these murders.
I have certain other leads to follow up.
Leads? What leads?
The Brussels police believe they have found Geisler.
Geisler. Red herring. Don't waste your time with him. Get me evidence against Pranzini.
But surely, Monsieur Guillaume.
I am under instructions from the office of the president. You understand, the president? We have to restore public confidence in the police and silence these guttersnipe reporters. I have been ordered to secure a conviction, and we will obey those orders.
Gentlemen, you will find this Chateau Yquem absolutely stunning. It's the 1869. Oh, what can one say? Honey and musk roses and liquid gold, eh? A perfect compliment for the final course of our modest repast. Now let me see, what do we have? Omelette soufflé, charlotte russe au gingembre, pêche à la turque.
Come on, Professor. Don't keep us in suspense. What did you make of this Pranzini?
The fellow sounds like an absolute villain. He was obviously lying through his teeth.
Well, half the population of France would have agreed with you, Captain. The other half saw Pranzini as a romantic figure, a rogue, certainly, but a rogue with a sense of honour in matters of l'amour.
And you?
Well, when I observed Henri Pranzini that day, I thought to myself, here is a man who loves life. You know, he was manacled and surrounded by police. He'd been days in prison, interrogated several times. I couldn't agree with Tailleur that he was a pathetic creature. Oh, there was an animal vivacity about him. I could see why women were drawn to him. He seemed to regard his arrest as just another adventure in a life which had been full of adventures.
Perhaps murder was just one more fascinating experience for him.
Possibly. And yet, could a man who manifestly loved life deprive others of it so viciously? Anyway, the case against Pranzini was far from conclusive. The hunt for fresh evidence was intensified, and Tailleur personally set out on the Geisler track.
But I thought the inspector told you that, in his opinion, the Geisler evidence had only been planted by the real murderer.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, I think that as the days passed, Tailleur became more and more convinced of Pranzini's innocence. He hoped that the mysterious GG would cast some clear light on the case. So, Geisler became for him a sort of holy grail. And almost as elusive, he kept popping up and vanishing again all over the place.
A report from the Belgian police that Geisler had been seen in Brussels, and the indefatigable Tailleur was off, hot foot.
Monsieur l'Inspecteur, we're desolate. A man's disappeared. However, our colleagues in Antwerp think they've located your man.
Your name is Gaston Geisler?
Oui, monsieur.
Would you mind telling me where you were on 16th of March last?
Right here, monsieur, in a mine shop, where I have been every day for the last 20 years.
You have witnesses to that effect?
But of course, monsieur. My wife, my children, my customers, my neighbors, they...
On to Cologne to speak with the shopkeeper who provided the cigars found in Geisler's bag. No help there. Doggedly, Tailleur travelled to Breslau, where Geisler's shirts had been manufactured. There, patience was rewarded.
Ah, yes. Here we are. These were sold to a Frau Gutentag.
You have the address?
Oh, nein, Herr Inspector. It was only a small order.
Have you a town directory?
Certainly. Right here.
Good folk. Good man. Guten Tag. Well, there are pages of them.
It's a common name, Herr Inspector. Oh.
Two days and 27 Guten Tags later.
Yes, these are Georg's things.
Your son?
Yes. Is he all right? Has anything happened to him?
He is not at home, then.
No. He and my husband, they had an argument. Georg left. He just packed a bag and left.
When was this?
Last February, Inspector.
Do you know where he went, Frau Guttentag?
Oh, yes. He went to Paris. But surely you know all this, Inspector.
Why should I know it, madame?
Because you're police arrested him. He is in a Paris prison.
Prison?
Yes, I have a letter from him here. See the address for yourself.
Cell 81, 1st Division, Mazas Prison, Paris.
Oh, that must have shown the French police up for the dolts they are, scouring Europe for a murderer who's under their very noses.
Oh, yes, the newspapers were merciless, as you would imagine.
Still, they had got their murderer.
Monsieur Guillaume did not think so. He examined Guttentag himself and discovered that the young man had stayed in the Hotel Cailleur. He had used the assumed name Henri Geisler. He had left the hotel without paying on the 16th of March, and he had no alibi for the time of the murders. The poor penniless wretch had wandered the streets for some days and then thrown himself into the Seine.
Well, that's the action of a guilty man.
I thought you were convinced that Pensini was the murderer.
Well, they must have been hand in glove.
Well, such was certainly Inspector Tailleur's conviction.
Enter.
Monsieur Guillaume, I have just been refused access to Guttentag at Mazas prison. They referred me to you. Monsieur Guillaume, it is imperative that I continue my interrogation.
Calm yourself, Inspector. Take a chair. Now, it is not possible for you to examine Guttentag further.
Not possible?
Precisely. Georges Guttentag was released yesterday on my instructions.
Released?
Do stop repeating everything, my dear Tailleur. Guttentag was released because he has no relevance to this case.
But that has not been established.
Tracking Guttentag down was an excellent piece of work on your part. You have tidied up the Geisler myth. You have silenced the press. Now we can forget about Geisler and Guttentag and concentrate on the indictment of Pranzini. The trial begins on Tuesday. I imagine it will take you all your time to prepare your evidence.
But there are things I need to know. How did his clothing get into the Rue Montaigne house?
Doubtless Pranzini bought some of the penniless young man's personal effects.
But he denies ever having met Pranzini.
He won't be able to deny it in court, will he?
Why not?
By now he must have returned to Germany.
How beautiful the gardens are looking this year. I often stand here in this window and look at them. They have a very calming effect.
The defense lawyers
will have a very difficult job to track him down. And even if they do, he is not obliged to return to Paris to give evidence.
So that's why you were in such a hurry to release Guttentag. My God, to think I once respected you.
Tailleur, you are an excellent detective. You do your job and leave me to do mine.
I thought we were both concerned to discover the truth.
Do you know, I really think the roses are out earlier this year.
So there you have it, my friends. Those are the basic facts in the case of the murders in the Rue Montaigne. How say you? Was Henri Pranzini guilty or not guilty?
Well, he was obviously a thoroughly bad lot. The world would be well rid of his sort.
Mm-hmm. Shoot first and ask questions afterwards, eh? What do you think, Philip?
Well, the police case was obviously weak. I imagine everything must have hinged on how the lawyers presented the evidence at the trial.
Ah, yes, the trial. Here, in this interesting note case, are the press accounts of the court proceedings. You see how voluminous they are. The trial spread over 5 days. 5 days in a stuffy courtroom at the height of summer. Public and press crammed into every available seat. Everyone straining to hear the evidence. Participants in the drama that will decide the death or life of a fellow human being. Evidence is set up and knocked down. Arguments flaunt themselves and clash like knights at a tourney. Witnesses come and go. But the man everyone is waiting to see is the prisoner, the enigmatic Henri Pranzini. Not until the afternoon of the third day is he placed in the witness box by his counsel, Maître Demange.
Monsieur Pranzini, I will not trouble you with the alleged weapon which the police have been unable to produce in evidence, or the absence of an alibi, which the prosecution set so much store by. The trivia I have already disposed of. What I would like you to do is to tell the court, in your own words, how you knew Madame de Montive and when you saw her last.
I met Madame de Montive at a soiree given by a mutual friend some 3 weeks before her unfortunate death. We talked a great deal. She appeared to find my company congenial, She intimated that I might call upon her. I did so a few days later. She was not at home, so I left my card.
Did you call again?
Yes. A few days before her death. I think it was a Tuesday.
Your call was professional?
Certainly not. Purely social.
She received you in her sitting room?
Well, of course. Where else would she receive me?
Then at no time did you enter the bedroom?
I never saw the interior of her bedroom until the police showed it to me.
Mm-hmm. How did she appear to you?
Regine de Monti was a lady experiencing...
Speak up, man! The court cannot hear you.
Regine de Monti was a lady experiencing great sorrow. She was someone who needed friends, confidants, advisors. She was at the end of her tether.
Yes, and she found in you a kindred spirit.
I believe so.
She was not the only woman to find consolation in your friendship, was she?
No.
No. Now, you've heard the public prosecutor describe you as an unscrupulous man who battens upon defenseless women. How do you respond to that?
It proves only that the learned gentleman understands neither me nor women. I have many lady friends, yes. A few lovers, certainly. Most of them neglected, abandoned by their husbands, by society. Oh, in the fine houses and squalid apartments of this oh-so-civilized city, do you know how many lonely women there are? Women whose lives are empty, unfulfilled? Women who wilt like flowers in a dark cupboard because in our society where men hold sway, they are not allowed to blossom, to contribute the fragrance of their intelligence, their understanding to the course of human affairs. Madame de Monti was one such. Men she knew in plenty. Men who wanted but one thing from her. Men who would pay her with mere money, but denied her the companionship, understanding, love that she craved. Was it wrong of me to make up in some small way for the outrageous shortcomings of my sex?
Silence! I will have silence! Very eloquent, Pansini. If your relationship with the dead woman was so noble and pure, why did you deny all knowledge of her to the police?
Monsieur le Président, it was foolish. I confess it. But as prosecuting counsel has taken great delight in telling the court, I have had several brushes with the police in my colorful career. It has become a natural instinct to avoid such encounters whenever possible. In my experience, the police are unable to see a false conclusion without jumping to it.
So the trial goes on, until at last the dramatic closing moments are reached. The public prosecutor has stitched the patches of police evidence together to make, as he hopes, a mantle of guilt.
I have shown you how this desperate man struck up an acquaintance with the unfortunate Madame de Monti, not for the purpose of satisfying his lust, but to furnish his debauched way of life. I have shown how he acquired the murder weapon, how he equipped himself with the false Geissler clues with which he littered his victim's apartment. I have shown you how he struck down Regine de Monti, how the poor woman attempted to summon aid, how Prancini, without a modicum of pity, dispatched the maid and even a poor, innocent sleeping child. I have shown how he took the dead woman's jewels and how he was caught trying to dispose of them. Here is no crime of passion, gentlemen of the jury. Here is a planned, premeditated, callous massacre, the like of which neither I, nor I venture to suggest, anyone in this court has ever encountered. I have no hesitation in calling for the maximum penalty. For in such a truly appalling crime, there can be no extenuating circumstances. Regine de Monti, Annette Gremeret and little Marie were brutally done to death by the man who stands before you. The man whose arrogance throughout this trial speaks volumes. I will not tell you that the blood of his wretched victims cries for vengeance. We are not here to take revenge. It is justice that I demand. justice in full measure.
Maître Demange, you may now present your defense summation.
Gentlemen of the jury, I lack the eloquence of my learned friend. I am glad that it is so, for I speak not to move your hearts, but to convince your minds. To help you to see, like the honest and intelligent men you are, that no case has been made against my client. What is all this evidence against Prancini? What does it amount to? He will not tell us where he spent the night of 16th, 17th of March. Subsequently, he was found in possession of some baubles belonging to... This Geisler, who led the police such a song and dance, may have been a chimera, a myth created to confuse the agents of law and order. But the small, skinny man with the top hat and the turned-up collar, he is no myth. He exists. He went to Madame de Monti's apartment on the night of the 16th of March, and he murdered that unfortunate woman and her household. He is not Prancini. Yet the police made no attempt to track down the real assassin. Why not? Because they have in Prancini a man who will serve very well as a substitute. He was in possession of the dead woman's jewels. And very obligingly, he refuses to alibi himself for the time of the murder. But why, I hear you ask, why does the prisoner, standing now in the very shadow of the guillotine, not break silence? Why does he not name his lover? Surely it can only be because she does not exist. Gentlemen of the jury, that lady does exist. I know her name. No, gentlemen. You shall not have it from my lips. I remain as silent as my client. And for the same reason, we both know how dire would be the consequences for this nation of revealing the lady's name. That Prancini has become the confidant of someone so highly placed may surprise you. But his loyalty in protecting from vulgar scrutiny she who has befriended him should awaken not suspicion, but admiration. We come now to the night of the crime. He received those trifling jewels not knowing their bloody provenance. Now that was wrong. It made him an accessory to burglary. It did not make him a murderer. Now, Pansini's last words to me this morning were, plead for death or liberty. He wants life with its joys. Life with gambling and women. No halfway verdict which would confine him to a prison cell will satisfy him. Nor will it satisfy justice. The public prosecutor says, I want your head. Prancini replies, I want my liberty. Gentlemen of the jury, upon you falls the solemn responsibility of deciding which plea to grant. Rise to the level of your duty.
Silence! I cannot allow such a display in a court of law.
So this clever lawyer got Prancini off scot-free, did he?
The answer is here.
What? In your note case?
Yes, in the note case you so rightly admire. Please take it. Examine it closely. Philip, a little more of this splendid gem.
Did Prancini get off?
One newspaper reporter at the time wrote, a jury of women would have acquitted him, a jury of eunuchs would have recommended boiling oil. Unfortunately, Prancini was tried by 12 men.
They brought in a verdict of guilty?
Yes, and a very controversial verdict it was.
Did it put a stop to the murders?
The wave of killings in Paris stopped abruptly.
Well, there you are, then.
I wonder. Henri Prensini was executed on the 31st of August, 1887. Exactly 1 year later, on the 31st of August, 1888, Mary Nichols was hacked to pieces in the Whitechapel district of London.
The first Jack the Ripper murder?
Yes, sir.
Good God. You don't think...
It could be coincidence, of course, but consider all the similarities. Both men are the same mental type. My friends who specialize in these things call them psychopaths, I believe. Both attack prostitutes. Both use knives with almost surgical skillfulness. And both delight to run rings round the police.
But what about the jewels Pranzini handled?
Well, if the murderer could devise the false Geissler trail, he could just as easily plant the stolen jewelry on Pranzini. It may have been just another diversion. Tyre always felt that the assassin was playing a game with him. But, thanks to Pansina's altogether unexpected behaviour, it all turns out even better than the murderer could have hoped. With someone else actually condemned, it's obviously wise for the man to lie low for a while. But his craving cannot be indefinitely held in check. He must kill again. But Paris, France, is too dangerous a place to resume his activities, so he strikes in Whitechapel. And on the anniversary of Pansina's death, as much as to say, I'm back. I made idiots of the Sûreté, and I can make idiots of the London police.
So an innocent man may have been sent to the guillotine.
Who knows? All I can say is that in many minds a question mark still hangs over the execution of Henri Pansini.
What am I supposed to be looking at in this note case?
Why, the cover, Captain. The cover. Ingeniously wrought and tooled, is it not?
It's certainly very unusual. This graining and beige colour.
Yeah. After execution, Pansini's body came to the dissecting school at the university. Well, a common practice, as you know, Philip. Mm-hmm. One of my assistants hit upon a novel way of making himself some money out of this sensational case. He fashioned curious artifacts out of parts of the cadaver. Highly reprehensible, of course. So, Captain Danvers, you are holding in your hands poor Henri Pansini, or what's left of him. That note case is bound with his skin.
Oh! Giles, what else?
Captain Danvers, are you unwell?
What? Excuse me, but I must go. I'm feeling sick.
Poor Giles.
Surely it can't have been this excellent food. Perhaps it was something I said.
Gentleman, Murder is Served was written by Derek Wilson. Hector Porteous was played by Peter Jeffrey, and Inspector Tailleur by Christopher Ettridge. Giles Danvers was Cornelius Garrett, and Philip Delamain was Graham Pountney. Regine de Monteuil was played by Barbara Kellerman, and Georges the Waiter and Henri Prensini were Christian Rodska. Madame La Carrière was Peggy Ann Wood, Monsieur La Carrière, Henley Goodall, Monsieur Guillot was Jack Watson, and the Maître des Manges was John Moffat. Inspector Tricaldi was Philip Manicom, the prosecutor, Stephen Lyons, Madame Jordan, Joe Anderson, Lemoyne, Dominic Rickards, and Madame Fontaine was Joanna Mackey. Other parts were played by members of the cast. The play was directed in Bristol by Andy Jordan.